you know, I hearken back to 2022, where our drones were delivering insulin into besieged cities in Ukraine. So in the last 25 years, no other North American manufacturer has not gone bankrupt. But it's that purpose and that's that ethos of certainly not just me, but our entire company, racking credit cards up, second mortgages on homes, all the rest of it, you know, just to survive in order to see this actually get to the point where it's at today. And there's nothing that the rest of our company would rather do.
Our Bay Area innovator today is Cameron Chow, a serial entrepreneur, technologist, and current CEO of Dragonfly, a leading drone manufacturer. His journey is unlike any other, from founding his first company at the age of 14 to leading billion-dollar ventures, before losing it all, going bankrupt and homeless for 10 years. He then made a great comeback to become a successful CEO once again, this time with a different set of values. In this episode, Cameron opens up about what it takes to rebuild from rock bottom, the lessons learned through failure, and how he's applying them today, such as using his technology in working with county sheriffs on surveillance and operations along the southern border. This is Bay Area Innovators, and I'm your host, Steve Ispas. Cameron, welcome to our program.
Well, thank you very, very much for having me.
Cameron, great to have you here out of Vancouver, Canada. That's where you are now. So you had an amazing career in so many ways. And I really want to start with, you know, you had your first company, your first business at age 14. And then you, you're an entrepreneur. And then you went through a cycle where you went all the way to the bottom. And then you started again. It's very unique. I would love if you tell us a little bit about your start. What made you get into business? And coming down and how you came back up again, because that's just such an amazing story.
Wow. Well, so first of all, thank you very much for having me on and for the consideration. And thanks for the work that Epoch Times does. It's really important work, and any way that we can, you know, support that.
Thank you.
Appropriately, we definitely want to do that. So I grew up in a small farming community. My dad was a local butcher. He was a rancher also, and my mom was the local florist. So all I really knew was, small business, what they call kind of entrepreneurialism it wasn't a word back then. But that's all I really knew. So I didn't know that that education was really a route, or that there was, I just assumed that that's what I was going to be in the agricultural world, or I was going to have a small business of some sort. And so when I was about 14, I was lucky enough to, the computer revolution was on, and so I would piece together, PCs and sell them to the local businesses and farmers, and I also installed the dug ditches. I installed irrigation systems, and then from there I kind of went on and bought a little 1-hour photo business and. A little rental property, and just, kind of did those, maybe typical kind of things. But my father had always said to me, he said, you can go and get a job, in that job and or in your businesses, you need to understand finance and money, but, the rich know money, but the wealthy know people. So we were always very focused on, how do we connect with people? How do we contribute to community? How do we, make sure that what we're doing helps them succeed? And so he gave me a great training in that, but he didn't have any finance background. And so I was lucky enough to study a securities course and started to learn about the markets and some things like that. And so that gave me a little bit of background. But about 94, myself and my brother-in-law came up with this idea that there's this new thing called the internet, and the idea was, what about if we built servers in a central location and allowed this thing called the internet to access these servers, so that people didn't have to carry around, at that time, transportable computers, which I was building, literally in my garage and selling to people. They didn't have to carry these around, because they were the size of sewing machines, yes. Right? And a 5 megabyte hard drive was about this big, and cost thousands of dollars. And so they could actually, you know, have one computer in one place and a computer and just access it via a terminal. And so it was a novel idea at the time and not really well accepted, that's for sure. But we ended up getting a client in a small auditing firm that thought it was a good idea because they didn't want to buy these transportable computers and there were already computers at their clients' locations. And so I'll make a very long story short, that's kind of how it got started. Like we had a real application. So the primary software people were using at that time for small and mid-market firms was called Great Plains, which is now Microsoft Dynamics. And so they ended up doing it and implementing it successfully. And then this was back in the day where there were small regional audit firms. Now, of course, there's only three or four out there, big four, a few others. But and we got two clients and then three clients and then five clients and then eight clients. And we had a real little business.
There was this thing. I very much identify with that. In 91, when I was 21 years old, I had my first company as well. And it was very similar. I would have computer products, or either an entire computer or parts, that I would send to Romania for them to assemble. And that was my first business. Obviously, it didn't grow very much because the limit that people in Romania had to buy computers was very low. But I very much identify as like buying different hard drives and motherboards and monitors and built it together to build it. Now, then you got to bigger things, right? Soon after that.
Yeah. So this thing called the .com was on, and I can't say I really knew much about it, but we were, we kind of got classified as a .com business, and we had a significant New York bank approach us. So what else had happened at the time is that Microsoft had bought Hotmail. And so after we did Great Plains, we actually integrated the Microsoft productivity suite, Office and Excel and PowerPoint, et cetera, PowerPoint didn't exist at that time, into our offering. And it was the first subscription deal that Microsoft had ever done. So and so I happened to be in the right room at the right time shortly after they bought Hotmail, and they were like, what do we do with this thing? Like nobody really understood like client server type thing, and they were like, isn't that kind of what you guys do? And I was like, yeah. And they said, well, can you help us with this? And of course, I'm a salesman, so I said yes. No clue what I was talking about or what I was doing. And so we got to be deeply involved in kind of how that unfolded. And so because of that and some notoriety that we got contacted by a U.S. investment bank, and they, which was big, I didn't even know they were big, and they said, there's this thing called the .com, and you're this little business that's doing $80 million in revenue. Like, you want to go public? I'm like, sure, let's go. And next thing you know, we had a $3.5 billion market cap in 2000 or 1999, and I was 25, 26, and didn't know what I was doing. And it was a great ride. I learned a ton. Prototypical, got fired about a year later, which was a good move for the company because I didn't, I really didn't have the experience to be operating at that level. But I was able to get a little bit of liquidity, so that was fortunate. So I went and invested, I think I was the first outside investor in a company called NetTeller, or close to one of the first, and got involved with them. And so that company ended up going public in London, and it became the largest mover of money in the offshore gaming space. And so again, just probably, seemed like good fortune at the time, but unfortunately I really thought I knew what I was doing and I didn't. So things continued to kind of progress. I was doing, acting like a big shot financer, flying around on jets and that kind of stuff. And I was in New York for some meetings and was walking into the base of the towers on 9/11. And for sure, life-altering event, not as much for me as for most, or certainly that were there. And my hearts go out to them, obviously. All those that affected by it. My life was already kind of spiraling in the wrong direction, but that really solidified it. That was the first night I remember thinking I'm just going to go get drunk. And I did. About 8 months later, I had disappeared. are completely checked out of life, or, you know, drinking progressed into harder substances, ended up, you know, living on the street.
Would you say it was only the drinking that created this downward spiral?
Oh gosh, no. The drinking was a symptom of the challenges and the out of controlness of my life and the ego and everything else that were, you know, and the drinking just became a way to mask or cope with, you know, my own, you know, behaviors and ego, and you know, and then drinking turned into hard drugs, and you know, as hard as you can imagine. So quite quickly, I just completely checked out, didn't make any decisions, lost everything over the course of about 2 years.
Wow.
And that, you know, that was, you know, 20-ish years ago now. So I was very, very lucky, grace of God, loving family, great friends, great friends. You know, I was able to get myself cleaned up, many trips to rehab, many trips to, you know, that type of stuff. And so since that time, I, you know, again, grace of God, I'm clean and sober, and best thing that could have happened to me, for sure.
For someone 25 years old to have, you know, billions of dollars company, it's probably not easier to handle. I wonder, are you like now telling young entrepreneurs how to handle this? You know, it's probably very difficult, right, to have that much money or that much glamour at that young age, right?
Yeah, and, you know, some folks, you know, there are certainly many other people, you know, as a percentage, very few, but there are many other people that have been in that situation, an even greater situation than that. And you've seen them handle it with grace, and you've seen them handle it with, and they've been successful. So if you think of, you know, the Zuckerbergs or the Jobs or the Gates of the world or those types of things, you know, their intellect and brilliance is far beyond mine ever I could imagine it to be. But also they're, you know, they've got a level of maturity, like them or not or whatever, that allowed them to sustain it. And I didn't have that. But for the majority of the rest of us in the world that may find ourselves, you know, chasing success and you know, sometimes it's the worst thing that you catch. It's like that dog that caught the car. You know, you hang on to that tire and you're going to go around the tire and get run over. And that's exactly what happened. And quite often people don't survive it. And again, I was lucky enough to survive it. And I wouldn't trade wealth and fame for the peace of mind that I have today for anything.
Absolutely. Well, I definitely want to talk about your company Dragonfly that's been making news, that you're working with the Cochise County in Arizona to protect the border. But before I go there, I want to get a sense of what was the moment that you were able to come out of this sad, you know, environment, right? You were on drugs, you were on the homeless. How did you come out of it? What made that change?
So I mean, I had gone through several episodes of seizures and overdoses and the list goes on, and missing Christmases and all those types of things. You know, subconsciously, I just assumed that I was going to die, and I kept not dying. Like every overdose, I just kept not dying. And I finally just got tired. I was like, fuck, if I'm going to have to live. And whether that was remorse for 9/11 or just my own insecurities or whatever that led up to that, I was just like, okay, well, if I'm going to be here, like, I'm just tired of being tired, just so tired of being tired. And so at that point, I finally didn't have an expectation that my life would be defined by success, but that my life would that my life anyway, for whatever it's worth, everybody's got their own journey, was going to be defined by you know, being alive each day, I just be grateful for it. And so, like, I know that success isn't, I know that it's empty. And so if I get to live in the day and enjoy whatever the day is bringing, then that's all there is. That's all there needs to be. And so I was like, okay, well, I certainly didn't have a religious bent at that time, and I certainly do much more now. And it's like, okay, well, if God's going to, you know, keep you on this earth, you know, I may as well make the best of it and be alive each day. And so I was just too long of an explanation. I was just sick and tired of being sick and tired.
Wow, that's amazing to make such a comeback and to to pretty much come back into the business world, right? And then you were able to start new companies and get to where you were before, pretty much, right?
Well, from a monetary standpoint, absolutely not. We've had a couple of modest wins over the year. We built a company called Earthcast and sold it to a group that took it public, where me and another co-founder had a company where we built cameras and put them on the outside of the International Space Station. And they were doing Earth observation work, selling the data to hedge funds and governments, and not highly sensitive data, but really interesting data. It was the first and still is the only video camera in space. Now that camera today is turned off, it's not on, because it sits on the Russian side of the space station, but the servers are on the US side of the space station. So this is, the day we turned, I don't think this is a coincidence, but the day we turned the cameras on initially was the day that Russia invaded Crimea. And so the political understanding and the experience that I got from that, but the whole company got from that, was really quite amazing. Anyway, the cameras worked for and the company that bought us and took it public did well, and I don't know exactly how they're doing today, but that particular camera system is not turned on today.
So is that the reason is not turned on is because of the war in Ukraine? Is that the reason?
I believe so. Yeah.
Wow.
I think relations have changed significantly. I think in particular during the Biden administration that was no longer an option. But very interesting. So that was a modest win, but since, and I've had a couple of little wins, I've definitely had some things that have not worked out as well. But about 15, a little bit, right around 15 years ago, I was developing some software with the team to be able to automatically upload GoPro software to social media, but it would cue your GoPro to turn on and off and record only things depending on what was happening with your phone that you had in your pocket. So if I was a snowboarder and all of a sudden the accelerometer in my phone would speed up or it was spinning, it would turn the camera on automatically. The extreme sport market is not overly prosperous, at least it wasn't for us. So we ended up talking with a bunch of law enforcement agencies that were looking to have that similar or type of technology used in their body cameras. And so that's how we got talking. And they introduced me to this company called Dragonfly, which was building drones. And I got to meet Zen and Dragon, Dragan, who founded it. And I was like, man, this is the future. Like, this is, nothing collects data better than a drone. Like, this thing is amazing. And they were like the world leaders at the time. So I put a little investment group together and we bought the company. Zenon stayed with us for a number of years. He's retired now. And so for the last 15 years, we've been bumping and grinding to keep this thing alive. And so today we're, at least to the best of my knowledge, we're the oldest dual use drone manufacturer in the world. The first drone that was ever credited with saving a human life is a Dragonfly drone. It sits on permanent display in the Smithsonian. And there's likely a dozen different police and law enforcement museums throughout the United States in particular that feature Dragonfly drones as their first drones. And so it's an incredibly privileged position to be in. And the ethos of the company takes that very, very seriously. We're very committed to public safety and defense of our security.
So now tell us, you're working again with the Cochise County in Arizona. You're working directly with the sheriff there to protect the border. Mm-hmm. Tell us specifically, what does it entail? What do the drones do and what's going on?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So Cochise County is recognized as the leading, or certainly one of the leading sheriff's departments, or that do border management. They have an incredible system, homegrown, internally built, of highly sophisticated but inexpensive camouflage cameras along their border, the area of the border that they manage, which now extends beyond their particular county because they've done such a great job of it. They've been visited and highlighted by both President Trump and Vice President Vance for whatever that's worth, and the governor, et cetera, et cetera. They have their own internal AI system that they built that helps really recognize the pervasive RGB feed or visual feeds that come in and can determine many, many characteristics about objects that are moving through that area. Is it human trafficking? Is it drugs, maybe even what type of drugs, is it livestock, you know, it just incredible what they've done internally. So they have a desire to tie that in with visual observation or with advanced sensors or data. And every time that they've looked at drone type of applications, one, they've generally had to rely back to purchase Chinese manufactured drones, which is, as many people may now know, has a real security concern.
Yes.
Not just from actual, you know, eavesdropping or intelligence, but also from a supply chain perspective. But the challenge is they all generally have about 30 minutes of flight time. And, you know, that's not enough time for them even to get from their operations base to the border and back. So much less, you know, conduct an operation. So there's generally two types of drones out there. There's a fixed wing drone, obviously has wings that look like an airplane, and very good for long loitering times, high altitude, ISR, intelligence surveillance reconnaissance type missions. Or the other type of drone is a multi-rotor drone, which is really good for lifting payloads, staying in place, doing interdictions, you know, kind of prosecuting a situation, but has very poor battery life. So they said, "Listen, if we could figure out a way to combine these two, you know, we'd really be on the leading edge." So what we've designed with them as the lead, and really taking in their concept of operations around what the design has to do, is we've designed a drone. It's about 9 feet in diameter. It has 270cc cubic centimeter engines on it that feed a battery management or a power distribution system and then hybrid batteries. So this drone can fly for about 9 hours. I wouldn't even call the ceiling, but can easily operate 15 to 20,000 feet at altitude and can carry up to 100 pounds. Its operational window that it works best in is about a 35 to 40 pound payload, which could be equipment, medical supplies, camera systems, communication equipment, you name it, whatever's on board, whatever sensor, acoustic listening devices, whatever it is, or multiples of those. And it could operate in that environment with the battery drain on it for about 3.5 hours. So now what they have is they have a system that's being deployed. It will go operational in mid-November. But now what they have is a system that's being deployed that can do true ISR work, tie into their artificial intelligence, connect with all of their ground cameras. But it can also provide a communication link, close ground support for personnel that might be involved in interdictions or might end up having to do overnight stays or might be in communication weather situations where they've got to have a mesh network stood up. It can deliver medical equipment. It can deliver supplies. If they've got a large interdiction that's happening and they need an extra air power involved, not that it's shooting anything. But this, I mean, when this thing comes down, and it's in front of you, you're stopping. You're not going anywhere. You may run for about 3 minutes and then realize, one, because of the heat or the cold, you're not gonna go very far, and two, this thing isn't going away. So it just, and it can provide real-time data in all of those situations. It also has a capability to tie into multiple commands. So you might have Customs and Border Patrol, you might have other sheriff's departments, you might have other local police, you might have even military that need to see the feed of what's going on at any given time, and all of that capability is built into it. And this is for, you know, in the range of $100,000.
Wow. Well, that's what I was going to ask. So the way it would work is that the drone observes something, so it can do two things. One, it can actually land and deter that person, or it can get troops or police or sheriff to come there, right? To intercept.
Yeah, they know the exact location, or it can deliver equipment. So you might have personnel that are out in a situation. They might be it might not just be an interdiction to prevent a crossing. You might have human trafficking going. Like, one of the things that really helps us feel really good about how we're supporting Cochise in particular is they're very concerned about the humanitarian aspect, yes, of this. So they have situations where human trafficking trains are coming across, and you've got people that are dehydrated, they might need EpiPens, they've got medical conditions, they might not be in the best condition because they may have been beaten or they may have been forced, those types of situations. So you can get medical equipment to those people, and you can two-way communicate with them at that same time. Or you can provide close personnel support for those folks when you've got your personnel officers on the ground trying to administer medical help or trying to keep a situation where they're actually acting in a humanitarian, not necessarily an enforcement role. Those things, it's just so incredibly heartening. Like, that is at the top of their list in terms of, like, they are law enforcement, but they are very, very focused on humanitarian and search and rescue, etc. So, and again, for people that are crossing or safety of their own personnel.
Sounds like an amazing contribution to defend the border. Now, what portion of the border are your drones involved with? Is it?
Well, so at this point, it is a pilot project. We have very high expectations, probably too high expectations, and lots of indications that this will expand across, if it's successful, across the southern border, but also the northern border. And we certainly have indications from the Canadian northern border, or their southern border, that, you know, they're watching this closely as well. So right now, it's an 80-mile strip. You know, that Cochise County is very specific, and that's where we'll keep the pilot. And we're going to spend a lot of time, leading up to going what they call TRL 9, which is operational level. We'll spend a lot of time doing testing, but even after that, we're going to test, and not just test the equipment, but test the concept of operations, the use cases. What are all the different ways this being used? I think what's most exciting about this is the learnings that everybody hopefully will be garnering out of it.
Now, you've been involved with maybe tens of companies. Do you feel different about this one, in the sense that do you feel more rewarded for the fact that you may be helping someone in distress, or you may be helping catching a criminal? Does it give you a different kind of reward for you as an entrepreneur?
Yeah, without question. I think, quite luckily, whether I do it to justify it to myself or not, we always try to, what's the bigger purpose of what we're doing? But in the case of Dragonfly, maybe just because of a confluence of circumstances and where the world's at historically and such, and where the technology is at, it is probably the most impactful technology that I could imagine being involved with. Largely because it involves so many other technologies. So we talk about the impact of AI and what it may have, good, bad, or indifferent. But this is where that type of technology and thinking actually gets put into practice, right? And when you've got an aerial platform that can do what these things do, I hearken back to 2022, where our drones were delivering insulin into besieged cities in Ukraine. There's nothing I'd rather do. There's nothing that the rest of our company would rather do. So it's meaningful. And I think it's the reason that we've survived. So in the last 25 years, no other North American manufacturer has not gone bankrupt. Except for the last maybe 5 or 6 years, where a new wave of startups has come in, very well funded. And a good amount of them are going to make it this time, because the regulatory environment, Ukraine, military, a bunch of stuff, the world's ready for drones now, where the last 25 years it was dominated by the Chinese, who could produce a low cost, kind of consumer, prosumer type product that North American manufacturers couldn't deal with, or couldn't compete with. But it's that purpose, and that's that ethos of certainly not just me, but our entire company, that, racking credit cards up, second mortgages on homes, all the rest of it, just to survive in order to see this actually get to the point where it's at today. So without question, purpose is unbelievably important.
You mentioned the recognition you got from the administration. How about the county or the people who live in that area, the citizens, the people in Arizona? Did you get any feedback? How do they feel about this operation?
I would say, initially this was pushed forward by the Sheriff's Department, who are very forward thinking, and they are completely one thing about that particular Sheriff's Department is they're very in tune with their community. They really understand clearly what their community wants, and what happens at that border affects that community, because as soon as they get past that border, now that drug or human trafficking or whatever is in their community. And so the sheriff is is unbelievably aware of that. But you know, so we were brought in. I had no working knowledge of the area really, you know, at that time. But certainly, I would say over the last 6 weeks, the amount of outreach that we've had from, say, local people, press in particular, who are incredibly proud of the work that that sheriff's department is doing. Again, not because it's like enforcement and da 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 da, but because it's about, you know, what's good for the community. And many of those folks that are coming across are like they're forced into it, but whether they're carrying drugs, whether they're you know, human trafficking, you know, some, there are some true bad guys, right? There's no question there's evil going on there. But you know, I don't know, maybe the majority of those folks are in situations they don't want to be in. And the people of that community really care about that, and they're very, very proud of the work that the Cochise Sheriff is doing.
Well, thank you for sharing that wonderful story. That's very amazing. It's fantastic. Now, I want to ask you, how would you define success? You know, many people define success as being financially stable, as building a company, making $1 million. You've been so many episodes in your life. What is your definition of success in your life?
Yeah, if I can sleep well at night. Yeah, maybe two things, and it is much more complicated than this. But if I can sleep well at night, and if I can wake up excited about the day, if I can do those two things. And that often doesn't happen, right? Because I'm worried about something, or I've made a mistake and I've got to own it, or I've embarrassed myself because I didn't do the best job I could have done. And so it's those very small things, like if I can go to bed every night thinking I did the best job I could do, I contributed to people, I owned my side of the street, completely owned my side of the street, didn't point a finger, didn't, you know, just owned it, and got up the next day and was excited about, you know, the work that we get to do. There's whatever happens after that's bonus.
I think you mentioned before that the ego was a big part of your spiraling down, of your downfall. What would be your advice to people in your position, how to bring up that humbleness in order to avoid, you know, because obviously when you make it in so many ways, your ego will increase, will get big, you know, things will happen. What's the way to solve that?
Well, candidly, it's getting connected to something bigger than myself, and where a lot of us, myself deeply included in this, is, you know, I thought I was the center of the world, and I was the center of my world, and candidly, I just didn't know any better. I didn't know, and it took an extreme humbling for me to hope, you know, and I got to work at it every day still. But it took an extreme humbling for me to get to a spot where I'd be open to that. The best way that I stay connected to something bigger than myself, whatever it is, right? You know, whether it's a purpose, a cause, a God, whatever does, you know, I have no ethos to prove to or platform to preach that anything about that on. But it's you know, I take time to be quiet. I take time to meditate. I take time to listen. And if I do that, I realize, the more I do that, the more I realize that everything is connected. I'm a pretty logical right brain person. I like to think in terms of like, what can you prove and what's the data say and everything else. And the more I look at that, the more evidence is that everything is connected. And so, I just be quiet, listen. Meditation is an incredible way to start to understand that connection. I know that's probably not what business-minded people want to hear. I'm a very business-minded person, I think. But that if I had a secret weapon, and it's not so secret, but that would be it.
Cameron, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it. Any concluding thoughts?
Yeah, candidly, the work you guys do is great, and we really appreciate being here. And if there's some way we can support more of what you do, that's what we'll do.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time, and best of luck with what you're working on and continue.
Very much.
Thank you. Thank you for watching another episode of Bay Area Innovators. If you enjoyed this episode and you know someone who should be on our show, please send us an email at sfbay@epochtimes.com. We would love to hear from you. Thank you, and see you next week.